She will not have a
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. My name is James McDougall. I'm a fellow of Trinity College and a tutor in history there, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of the college to the inaugural lecture in the Humanitas Visiting Professorship in Historiography. The professorship is hosted at Trinity College, and it's been made possible by the vision of Lord Weidenfeld and his Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and by the generosity of Mr. Len Blavatnik and the Blavatnik Family Foundation. We're very pleased to be able to welcome both Lord Weidenfeld and Mr. Blavatnik to the lecture tonight. The Humanitas program, as some of you may be aware, is a series of visiting professorships in the arts, the humanities, and the social sciences at the universities of Oxford and one other. And over the next 5 years, the chair in historiography will be bringing a series of extremely distinguished historians to Oxford to address a series of very major themes in contemporary historical research and writing. When we were thinking of the way in which we would organize the program and with what topic to begin, we could hardly have come up with a more emotive, more significant, both in intellectual and in public political terms, and a more difficult topic than the history of the Holocaust. And we could hardly have thought of a better person to address that particularly difficult topic than Professor Saul Friedländer, and we're very much delighted to have him here with us tonight as our inaugural holder of this chair. And to introduce Professor Friedländer, I'm going to hand over now to the head of the Division of Humanities, Professor Shira West. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, James. It's a really great pleasure and honor for me to introduce Professor Saul Friedländer, who's the Distinguished Professor of History Emeritus and the 1939 Club Chair of Holocaust Studies at UCLA. As Professor Friedländer puts it, he was born, quote, at the worst possible moment, 10 months before Hitler came to power in Prague, 1932. His grandfather was a textile manufacturer. His father, the vice president of a German-Czech insurance company. He wrote in his 1978 memoir that the family's Jewishness didn't change the fact that at home, everyone felt themselves to be German. His family fled to France after the occupation of Czechoslovakia. Saul, under an assumed name of Paul Henri, he was hidden by his parents in a Catholic children's home. His parents were arrested in September 1942 while trying to flee to Switzerland. He immigrated to Israel in 1948 at the age of 15. He is a pioneer of scholarly study of contemporary history and its relation to personal and social memory. His memoir, When Memory Comes, which was first published in French in 1978, is both an autobiography and a reflection on successive stages of the conflict in the Middle East. He is the co-founder of the journal History and Memory. He was professor of history at Tel Aviv and then at UCLA, and he has written on history and psychoanalysis, on Pope Pius XII, on Nazi Germany's foreign relations with the United States, and on the future state of Israel, as well as his work on the Holocaust. He has won the MacArthur Foundation Award, which is known in the United States as the Genius Grant, in 1999, and in 2008, the Pulitzer Prize for the second volume of Nazi Germany and the Jews, The Years of Extermination, 1939 to 1945, which one reviewer in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung described as a masterpiece of historical writing with the urgency and truth of a work of art. It's my very great pleasure to welcome Professor Friedländer to give her talk today entitled Trends in the Historiography of the Holocaust. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this introduction. I am pleased and honored to be here. Coming from Southern California, I am particularly impressed by the weather, of course, but it's really a great pleasure to be to inaugurate this chair in historiography. Ladies and gentlemen, I will try to keep the lecture not too technical, of course, but not too general either. And I hope you will forgive my accent, which is a mixture of French, Hebrew, German, and whatever. But I'm speaking in English. In 1989, François Furet declared that the French Revolution on its 200th anniversary had finally passed into history. In other words, it had moved away from the fuzzy twilight zone of intertwined history and memory that surrounds several epochal events of modern times and turns them, in Eric Hobsbawm's words, into, quote, the hardest part of history for historians or anyone else to grasp, end of quote. The Holocaust may be the starkest example of such epochal events. Thus, in this lecture, I shall follow the interaction between public memory of the extermination of the Jews of Europe with its varieties of mass media representations and misrepresentations of political exploitation by erasure or by emphasis, and a complex historiographical evolution, nowadays branching off in all possible directions and yet still dwelling in that twilight zone of intense emotional reactions. First, I shall turn to the three post-war decades. During the first 10 years, this historiography was limited at best, actually practically non-existing. Then it started to grow still very slowly from the early 60s to the late 70s. In the second part, I will deal with its very rapid expansion from the 80s to this day, and with some of the major directions taken at present. This will lead me, in a last section, to comment on the possibilities and limits of historical conceptualization in this domain. One, fragile beginnings and slow transformation from the late 40s to the late 1970s. Nazism as such became a domain of historical analysis even before Hitler's accession to power. The first Marxist analysis of German fascism was published in the 1920s, and soon thereafter, on the liberal side, the notions of totalitarianism and a special cause, Sonderweg, of German history took hold. From then on, the flood of historical publications never stopped. In these early historical studies, Nazi antisemitism barely surfaced, if at all, although the persecution and extermination of the Jews was widely recognized in the Allied countries during the war, of course, even if official Allied attitudes remained the object of historical controversy. From the late 40s, however, after the Nuremberg trial of the major war criminals, there was a succession then of smaller trials, but after the major trial, silence descended on the public scene about these events. In historiography, that silence was shared by British and American scholars who, from the end of the war, concentrated essentially on the political history of the Third Reich, A.G.P. Taylor, Alan Bullock, Trevor Roper, and so on. Of course, such political history could stand on its own, and it did, without mentioning the crimes against humanity and the extermination of the Jews in particular. In the communist bloc, the Jewish victims of Nazism were not considered as such, that is, as Jewish, but as non-specific victims of fascism. Violent outbursts of anti-Semitism, first in the Ukraine, then in Poland, Kielce, may have instilled some pragmatic considerations into the official ban on identification of the Jews as specific victims. And in the early 50s, Stalin's anti-Semitic campaign effectively dissuaded anyone to mention the Nazi massacre of the Jews in particular. In West Germany, and I will several times focus on Germany because, of course, it's the essential part of the starting historiography and the scene on which the debates are really played out. In West Germany, during the 1950s, the state of mind of a majority of the population has often been described and needn't be spelled out again. Here, one essential point needs to be stressed nonetheless: the lingering impact of Nazi anti-Semitic propaganda. The October 1945 Stuttgart Declaration of Guilt towards Jews of the Evangelical Church, for example, aroused considerable opposition within the ranks of the church itself. And according to repeated polls, approximately one-third of the population kept its anti-Jewish views. Of course, the historians played their role. The great old man of the profession, Friedrich Meinecke, led the way to normalization of the past with his Die Deutsche Katastrophe, adding a few anti-Semitic remarks for good measure. Gerhard Ritter, Ludwig de Hio, and Hans Rothfels, back from his exile in Chicago, followed. Moreover, and that's a recent point, the continued presence of two veterans, Werner Conze and Theodor Schieder, may have been quite influential, although that influence is difficult to assess. Both had been active Nazis. Schieder was close to the SS and to Gauleiter Erich Koch of the Ukraine. I may then add to this if asked later on. Both were explicit anti-Semites and promoters of ethnic cleansings in the East. Both were reintegrated among their peers. Schieder became professor in Cologne, and from 1967 to 1972, he was president of the German Historians Association, while Conze was professor at Heidelberg from 1957 to his retirement in 1979. In France, knowledge of German crimes was not repressed, but French collaboration in those crimes was out of bounds. This national taboo had been imposed by a similarity of political interest between the largest post-war party, the Communists. One usually forgets that at the end of the war, the first elections, the Communists were the largest party in France, who claimed a vast following of resistance, and their political enemies, the Gaullists, who claimed the same. In short, for both, most of France stood behind them, and the collaborators were a tiny minority of traitors. Historiography taught the officially accepted line. Moreover, la déportation, or les déportés, included all Frenchmen sent to Germany. No mention of the special fate of the Jews transported to their deaths appeared in French post-war categories of victims, and Robert Aron's widely read Histoire de Vichy hardly mentioned them at all. Even in 1969, after de Gaulle had left the presidency, a documentary film that unveiled something of the truth, Marcel Ophüls' Le Chagrin et la Pitié, The Sorrow and the Pity, was barred from French television, for which it had been created, and was broadcast only in 1981. It took the American historian Robert Paxton to write the first non-apologetic history of the Vichy regime in the mid-1970s, and it took Paxton and the Canadian historian Michael Mares to co-author the first general history of Vichy and the Jews, that's also the title of the book, in the early 1980s, 82 or 83. These two books showed the extent of Vichy's anti-Jewish initiatives and its collaboration in the deportation of the Jews, mainly foreign Jews. At the same time, however, diverse efforts to document Nazi criminality were underway. The Allies had assembled hundreds of thousands of German and other documents for the Nuremberg trials. On a different scale and with different goals, Jewish survivors collected all available information about the life and death of European Jewry. Throughout the war, in all occupied countries, hundreds, possibly thousands of individual Jews had been recording their own fate, while organized groups such as Emanuel Ringelblum's Onek Shabbat in Warsaw, or later Isaac Schneerson's group in Grenoble, gathered more systematically some documentation for future historians. Under the impulse of survivor historians such as Philip Friedman, Isaiah Trunk, and others, some monographs were published immediately at the end of the war. Mainly, the writing of recollections grew apace in displaced persons' DP camps, where historical commissions, in quotes, were set up. Some research started in small centers already in existence, such as YIVO in New York and the Wiener Library in London, as well as in new centers established in Warsaw, Paris, and Jerusalem. Much of the work in the DP camps was not professional history per se. The significant contribution of these mainly East European Jewish survivors found its expression over the years in the Yizkor Bicher, I say it in Yiddish, memorial books, collectively written about the life and death of hundreds of destroyed Jewish communities. In a somewhat different spirit, and here I am understating, major scholars of Jewish history were not yet ready to address events that, in their view, were too close in time to allow for any conclusions, in quote. I do not believe Gershom Scholem wrote in 1961, the greatest scholar in Jewish mysticism, that we, the generation who lived through this experience, are already capable today of drawing conclusions. But the impact of all that has happened, the image of the Holocaust, will of necessity dominate the agenda of Jewish studies. Actually, major Jewish historians backed away from this topic, which to them was maybe too difficult to deal with, and maybe was threatening Jewish studies. I never understood the motives, but the first generation, the generation of the war, backed off the topic. During the 1950s, Israeli contributions, particularly those coming from the Jerusalem Research Center Yad Vashem, were often sidetracked by ideological imperatives such as the glorification of the ghetto fighters in line with the image of the new Jew fostered by the state, as opposed to the so-called passivity of the Jewish masses, and more generally, the linking of the catastrophe in the diaspora to the unheeded warnings of Zionism, of course. Furthermore, early Israeli historiography of the Holocaust found it often difficult to disentangle itself from a publicly dominant myth, interpreting recent Jewish history as an evolution from catastrophe to redemption, the creation of Israel, in a continuous quasi-messianic process of ultimate salvation. Simultaneously, that obversely, that's an interesting point, Orthodox Jews commemorated the Holocaust by inserting it in archetypal molds, a tradition brilliantly described by Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi in Zachor. It was Churban, destruction again in Yiddish, like the destruction of the temple, or the latest in a series of major calamities having befallen the Jewish people as God's chastisement. Some added, chastisement for secular and prohibited Zionism. The 1960s and the very early, the 1950s and the very early 1960s saw nonetheless the publication of a few historical essays that included references to the Holocaust or straightforward historical accounts of it. Most notably, and you will all know the book, Hannah Arendt's Idiosyncratic, The Origins of Totalitarianism, which, of course, in the last chapter mainly deals a lot with the Holocaust. Leon Poliakov's Harvest of Hate, Gerald Reitlinger's The Final Solution, H.D. Adler's Theresienstadt, Wolfgang Schaeffler's Die Judenverfolgung im Dritten Reich, published in 1960, and of course, Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews, published in 1961. But apart from Arendt's volume, which fitted the Western anti-totalitarian crusade of those years, the other studies didn't reach a wide public. Hilberg, still unequaled to this day, unequaled history of the German murder machinery, was first translated into German in 1983. 22 years after its publication in English. Thus, it is not in books of history that the West discovered or rediscovered some dim traces of that past, but in some iconic text, in literature and films. The best-known case, of course, is the Diary of Anne Frank and the cult that soon surrounded her memory. Also, very quickly, it got an universal significance, and the Jewish aspect of it practically disappeared. Other examples include André Schwarzbart's novel, Le Dernier des Justes, John Hersey's The Wall, Leon Uri's Exodus, and Alain René's remarkable film, Nuit et Brouillard, Night and Fog, in which the word Jew did not appear, even once, but where Nazi extermination sites were presented with a starkness unequaled since then. Primo Levi's memoir of Auschwitz was written at that time, after the war, but found its vast readership only many years later. At the very end of the 1950s, the Swiss historian Walter Hofer's volume of documents on the Third Reich, published in Germany, and mainly William Shirer's 1960 hugely successful The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, albeit simplistic and marred by a multitude of mistakes, drew further public acknowledgement of the Holocaust. It was a beginning of sorts. In the 60s and 70s, the historiographical scene started changing. A growing number of specialized studies on the history of the extermination were generated by the research centers already mentioned, and of course, by the American-initiated Institute for Zeitgeschichte in Munich, which had its problems with Jewish scholars, mainly with Joseph Wolff, with Adler, later on with myself, but that's another story. The comprehensive two-volume expert studies the Institute prepared for the Auschwitz trials, later published as Anatomy of the SS State, dealt in exemplary detail with the SS, the camps, and with the history of the Final Solution as such. A series of trials, starting with the 1958, most of you will not know about it, Ulm trial, of members of Einsatzgruppe Tilsit, followed by the 1961 Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, and the Auschwitz trials in Frankfurt between 1963 and 1965 broke sporadically through a still prevailing avoidance of the history of the extermination. In a different way, two passionate controversies, the first one about Arendt's 1963 Eichmann in Jerusalem, in which he accused the Jewish councils of collaborating with the Germans and derided witnesses at the trial. The second triggered in the same year by Rolf Hochhuth's play The Deputy about Pius XII's silence in the face of the Holocaust also contributed to a growing public discussion of issues directly linked to these events. On the other hand, however, and that for us historians is important, a new wave of German historians led by Karl Dietrich Bracher remained fixated on the classic political history launched by the Anglo-Saxon historians of the Third Reich and on totalitarianism as an explanatory concept. In fact, and that's a point which usually is not known, two separate age groups that in terms of Vergangenheitsbewältigung, confrontation with the past, followed different paths, came into their own in the Bundesrepublik of the 1960s. The young people entering the public scene in the late 50s and the early 60s, and the future historians among them, were not the sons, but they were the younger siblings of the Third Reich's adult generation. They were Helmut Schelsky's skeptical generation, socialized in Nazi Germany, mainly in the Hayat, in the Hitler Youth. They either were in uniform at the end of the war or served as Flakhelfer, helping to man anti-aircraft guns. Their entire world collapsed in 1945, and the need for radically new political choices was more important than age determinism, except, of course, in terms of personal responsibility. As Chancellor Helmut Kohl put it, he and they were blessed with the grace of the late birth, die Gnade der späten Geburt, that is, born a little bit late, so that they were not responsible, of course, for what had happened. The sons and daughters of the adults of the Third Reich, in contradistinction with the younger siblings, found their voice in the student movements of the late 1960s and early 70s. They seemed to carry the promise of radical change of awareness regarding the past, as within thousands of families, they confronted their father's silence about their activities during the Hitler years. However, this youthful energy was soon deflected into theoretical channels that thoroughly limited the range of questions. Nazi Germany and the Bundesrepublik were both encapsulated in a reworked Marxist definition of fascism, in which Nazi racial theories and the Holocaust were not consonant with the fight of old new elites in defense of their power positions. Slightly earlier, however, a right-wing interpretation of Nazism as fascism, Ernst Nolte's Three Faces of Fascism, reached a wide academic audience. There, Nazi antisemitism became a central fixture of Nazi radical anti-Marxism. The antisemitism of the Hitler regime could also be part of Nazism's assault on transcendence in Nolte's somewhat Heideggerian addition to the anti-Marxist dimension. Now, some historians claim that they saw already in Nolte's first important book, this book, the later sounds of Nolte's positions, to which I will come very soon. I know only of one historian who wrote about it, and that's George Mosse, whom some of you have read and some of you know, have known personally. That's the only one who noticed something that would come back in Nolte's later writings and speeches. Two, into the present, ongoing issues and new directions. A major change in the awareness of the Holocaust started building up in the mid-1970s With the first International Historians Conference in New York in 1974 and with Lucy Davidovich's 1975, The War Against the Jews, becoming a bestseller in the US. But in order to surface, such changes need a powerful trigger. The trigger was, somewhat ludicrously, the screening of the NBC miniseries Holocaust in the US and in most European countries in 1978 and 1979. The Hollywood production created a massive public demand for information about the events that in turn changed the pace of historical scholarship, because historians suddenly had to answer. They were asked to be on panels and so on, and work started, strangely enough, as a result of a miniseries which most of you don't remember, which is unbearable, actually, today. The turnabout had not come easily, as we saw. Furthermore, during the 1970s, a weird new fascination with the Third Reich had swept Germany, Italy, and France, la mode rétro in French. In Germany, it was probably launched by Albert Speer's memoirs of 1970. Its possibly best-known historiographical expression was the 1973 Hitler biography by Joachim Fest, one of the ghostwriters of Speer's memoirs, that led to his film Hitler, Eine Karriere, Hitler, a Career. The film was soon taken off German screens. By the late 1970s, the Hitler Welle, the Hitler wave, was over. Films, television series, and political controversies followed one another throughout the 1980s and the 90s, with notable impact on the public awareness and with at times opposite agendas in the shaping of memory. Landsmann's Shoah, catastrophe in Hebrew, on the one hand, and Edgar Wright's Heimat, Homeland, television series on the other, later Schindler's List and the like. And from the 1980s on, controversies started. In the historian's domain, intentionalism that focused on Hitler's role, on ideology, and on a succession of identifiable decisions, also regarding the extermination of the Jews, was possibly best expressed already earlier on in the work of the Stuttgart historian Eberhard Jeckel. It was opposed by structuralism or functionalism that found an early version in Karl Schleuness, The Twisted Road to Auschwitz, and set the emphasis on the loose structure of the Nazi decision-making system, on haphazard initiatives dictated by unforeseen circumstances, and by a quasi-independent process of internal competition for power that Hans Mommsen defined as cumulative radicalization. Incidentally, both tags were launched in 1979 by the British historian Tim Mason at an international conference on the Third Reich hosted by the German Historical Institute at Cumberland Lodge, during which the Holocaust wasn't apparently mentioned even once. Martin Brochard's 1982 article, Hitler and the Genesis of the Final Solution, may be seen as a foundational structuralist text about the origins of the Holocaust. I will explain that later if need be. According to their critics, the intentionalist supposedly limited responsibility to Hitler and to his closest acolytes, while the structuralist, in their opponent's view, diluted all personal input so much that individual responsibility disappeared in a haze of abstract processes and unplanned moves. Both positions led to the debate about the relations between center and periphery in the policies of the Third Reich. While for the intentionalist, all important decisions were taken at the center in Berlin or wherever Hitler was, the structuralist argued that at best, Hitler would formulate some guidelines that agencies all over occupied Europe would reshape in line with local needs and circumstances. At times, the triggering initiatives would come from the periphery in the structuralist view and be adopted by Berlin, as suggested by Hans Mommsen in his 2002 study on the origins of the final solution, in which he claimed that the early extermination measures were initiated by Odilo Globocnik, the SS and police leader of the Lublin district in the General Government, accepted by Himmler and then formalized by Hitler. Regarding these dynamics, it seems to me that Christopher Browning coined the right formula. Hitler delegated much responsibility to the periphery in economic, social, and general internal matters, while in foreign affairs and military matters, he micromanaged every possible issue. In terms of racial policy, particularly in its application to the Jews, he would formulate wishes, at times directives, that Himmler and his acolytes would interpret and implement. And Christopher Browning says, to know what Hitler thought, you have to follow what Himmler did. In the public domain, the major controversy of those years, although historiographical in appearance, was mainly political. While 1983, 50 years after Hitler's accession to power, did not rattle the historiography of the Third Reich nor create much of a public stir, 1985, 40 years after the end of the war, did. The fateful date's significance was amplified by public acrimony surrounding the forthcoming meeting of President Ronald Reagan and Chancellor Kohl in Germany at the Bitburg Military Cemetery, where American soldiers were buried next to members of the Waffen-SS. The reason for this mishap was that the decision about Bitburg was taken when snow covered the ground. When the snow melted, it was discovered that there were American soldiers buried next to the Waffen-SS who had killed American prisoners in the same offensive, the Battle of the Bulge. Moreover, a stream of articles filled the German press about the need for a Schlussstrich, a final stroke, after 40 years of supposedly constant reminders of Germany's Nazi past. Thus, the conservative historian Goloman, Thomas Mann's eldest son, asked in Die Zeit in February 1985 whether anybody in France would have had the idea of commemorating Waterloo 30 or 40 years later. This tense environment unleashed a confrontation that shook the historian's profession in Germany and beyond. The historical strife, or historian's controversy as it became known, pitted conservative German historians against the country's most prominent philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, and against liberal left historians. Officially, the debate was about the uniqueness of the Nazi extermination of the Jews. That is the subtitle in the volume Historical Streit, and the subtitle is about the uniqueness of the extermination of the Jews. The right wing, emphasized the similarity between the Holocaust and Stalin's Gulag. Nolte went even further and stressed the priority in time of the Bolshevik exterminations. Thus, he explicitly defined the Gulag as the original and Auschwitz as a copy. The underlying political motivation for the conservatives' arguments stemmed from a turn to the right in West German politics, Die Wende, in the late 1970s, and an urge for national self-assertion, according to Michael Stürmer and others at that time. While the history of the Holocaust and other Nazi crimes expanded, also as a result of the newly accessible documents kept in former Soviet archives, a new generation of scholars entered the field. In Germany, these were the grandchildren of those who had been adults during the Third Reich. By all counts, they were and are stricter than their predecessors. At the same time, an ever wider array of German institutions became further implicated in the history of the Reich's criminal activities, particularly the Wehrmacht. In cases of administrative continuity, not only was past history studied, but so was the handling of that past history by the relevant institutions, as illustrated very recently in a volume about the German Foreign Office, Das Amt. Non-German institutions were swept into the investigations. Bank, mainly Swiss, and insurance companies, Allianz and others, that held accounts of Jews who perished in the Holocaust and refused to restitute the money to their legal descendants, European industrial enterprises that exploited slave labor during the war, and so on, and so on. A vast field of business and financial history linked directly to the expropriation and extermination of the Jews and to the exploitation of slave labor opened entirely new archives and historiographical vistas. In the Swiss case in which I was involved, the Swiss government opened for the first time archives it had never shown about the commercial relations between Switzerland and the Third Reich in great detail. And in a way that was a first. The study of the banks compelled the banks to open their accounts for the wartime and so on. So we have suddenly a new field in the history of the Holocaust beyond the political and the merely direct criminal and so on. From new sources, such as Himmler's service diary, Diensttagebuch, found in the Soviet archives, to the periodic declassification of Bletchley Park decodings, very important. They knew about the numbers of Jews exterminated in all the major extermination camps exactly at the date where the Germans wrote reports about those numbers. Actually, the British, Bletchley, knew about it before the Germans in Berlin knew it because the decoding was better than the reception of the original message in Berlin, which had to be repeated twice or three times in order for the authorities there to understand what was being sent. The new series of Jewish responses to persecution published under the auspices of the Memorial Museum in Washington, contemporary historiography encompasses the Holocaust at all levels, both in the widest synthesis about the Third Reich, such as Ian Kershaw's or Richard Evans's works, as well as in the most specific aspects. The centrality of the economic dimension is stressed in Götz Ali's research, or from another angle in Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands. The course of the extermination in every area of Eastern Europe is systematically studied, from Dieter Pohl's work on Galicia to Christian Gerlach's study of White Russia, from Wendy Lauer's work on the Ukraine to Christoph Dickmann's research on Lithuania and Jan Gross's report on Jedwabne that created a firestorm among Polish historians. It extends from Peter Longerich's biography of Himmler to the lives of scores of mid-level Nazi figures involved in mass murder like Ulf Schmidt's Karl Brandt or Wolfram Wette's Karl Jäger. It dwells on the deportations from the West, as well as on the involvement of national churches, and repeatedly it attempts to decode the silence of Pius XII. From being the pariah of the historiography of Nazi Germany in the 1950s, the Holocaust has possibly become the most thoroughly researched domain of this and related historiographies at the beginning of the 21st century. Various elusive issues are periodically revisited. This applies to the numerous attempts to pin down the immediate origins of the final solution. As you know, we have no written document, except for something very close. In the service diary, Himmler's service diary, which I mentioned a moment ago, there is an entry for December 17, 1941, Führer, Judenfrage, ausrotten als Partisanen. Führer, that is meeting with the Führer, Jewish question, exterminate, ausrotten, as partisans, that is as eternal enemies, not the partisan fighting in Russia, which were being exterminated in any case. As I said, various elusive issues were being revisited, and the example is, among others, the pinning down the origins of the final solution, and according to Himmler's diary, it would be sometime in December of 1941 that is the decision was taken. From Martin Borchardt's 1982 article to Christopher Browning and Jürgen Matthäus' massive volume of 204, this issue is being restudied and reconsidered. There is no exact information about the beginning, the decision, the central crossing of the line to exterminate all the Jews of Europe. And quite naturally, one of the most elusive issues of all, that of knowledge, resurfaces again and again. Who knew what and when, mainly in Germany? Over the last decade or so, a spate of very detailed studies reversed Walter Laqueur's hypothesis, presented in his 1980 The Terrible Secret, that information was widely available but not understood. It appears now, according to Moritz Pfeiffer's most recent research published in 2012, that about 20 to 25 million Germans knew about the Holocaust while it took place and clearly understood what it meant. In his 2005 study of German wartime society, a masterpiece, Jörg Echtenkamp, also still minimizing the extent of open allusions to the extermination from late 1942 on, nonetheless offered an eloquent summary of that widespread awareness. And I quote Echtenkamp, "The lie of Auschwitz became the lie of German society, whereby secret knowledge of secret evil was passed off as ignorance. Living a lie was normality in German war society. Only a few beacons of truth rose above the sea of liars." End of quote. A new historiography of the Shoah rapidly developed in Israel after the Eichmann trial. It turned first and foremost to all aspects of Jewish existence on the path to extermination. Traditional archival sources were and still are complemented by hundreds of diaries whose chroniclers mostly perished, and by growing collections of oral history, mainly interviews with survivors. Furthermore, Israeli historiography has extensively dwelt upon a specifically national topic, the Yishuv, the Jewish community in Palestine's leadership response, and that of Ben-Gurion in particular, to the extermination in Europe. How did they behave? How did they respond? An Israeli historical Streit, or historian's controversy of sorts, developed mainly in the 1990s, opposing traditional Zionist positions to radical post-Zionist stances. From one angle, admission of the Palestino-centrism of a leadership that nonetheless search for ways to help European Jews, but had practically no means to do so. From the other perspective, a leadership oblivious to the situation in Europe and only intent in using it cynically for its own political purpose of building the foundations of the state. Three, and very shortly, on the possibilities and limits of conceptualization. Did the recent exponential growth of documentation and monographical studies in the history of the Holocaust produce any decisive conceptual breakthrough? The answer, in my view, is no. As we saw, the main conceptual frameworks referred to until the late 80s comprised fascism, totalitarianism, and of course a German Sonderweg special course in which from Luther to Hitler has become mostly from late 19th century to Hitler. For some historians, either German or European antisemitism remains the main driving force throughout. At the very end of the 80s, an additional approach was widely embraced, modernity, particularly as formulated by Zygmunt Bauman in Modernity and the Holocaust. In my view, for modernity to become significant in the interpretation of the Holocaust, it has to foreground a specific historical context independent of itself. That is, why modernity in Germany and not modernity in the United States and so on. You have to have modernity within a very specific historical context, which brings us back actually to the old explanations. Modernity was followed in the 90s and from the turn of the century on by comparative studies of colonialism or genocide as adequate frameworks encompassing the Holocaust and offering the tools to interpret it. Yet it seems to me that all these frameworks, the old and the new, apply only to the perpetrator's side of this history, if at all. That is, only to the policies of extermination. Thus, for example, the crucial role surrounding European society in the implementation of the Holocaust, and it was crucial, as forms and degrees of collaboration or abstention, of bureaucratic efficiency or chaos, widely differed from country to country, and these differences cannot find an application in the framework of colonialism, for example. And if we add the Jewish dimension to the full rendition of this history, all the new concepts become even more difficult to use. In my view, only an integrated approach in which the history of these events encompasses in a single narrative the perpetrators, the bystanders, and the victims can be viewed as a history of the Holocaust as a whole, as three different facets interact throughout. I may explain that later. We are facing a constellation of events in which thoroughly diverse historical processes converged at a given moment in time. They shared parts of a common context, the collapse of liberalism in continental Europe. But the forces that determined the revolution were thoroughly different. In short, it seems to me that no single overarching concept may interpret the history of the Holocaust if we consider that history in its totality. You may argue against total history, of course. It may thus be that such a multiplicity of historical factors leaves no other choice to the historian, and that's very controversial, but a return to the primacy of narrative, to some sort of elaborate historical chronicling, including partial interpretations, after, in Dan Diener's words, all conceptualization has failed. Concluding remarks. There is no way to tell how long the memory of the Holocaust may endure, except for the fact that the Holocaust seems to have become the measuring rod for the genocidal atrocities of our time. It happened in part as a result of its wide exposure to mass media, its easy political exploitation, and ironically, as a consequence of the negationist struggle against its history and its memory, the Irving trial, of course, in England. It also happened as a result of the unequaled amount of documentation that now helps to investigate every nook and cranny of that past, bringing to light details less accessible in other genocidal events. And for that same reason, the history of the Holocaust, also in constant dialogue with and often in opposition to the all-pervasive influence of mass-produced representations, does nowadays stand its scholarly ground by ongoing self-criticism and intense scholarly give and take. Thus, the extermination of the Jews of Europe will probably continue to challenge the minds of many in the foreseeable future, as like the other genocides of our time, it puts into question the very core of human civilization. And I am quoting now, "One has touched there," Habermas once wrote about Auschwitz, "on something which represents the deep layer of solidarity among all that wear the human face. It has changed the basis for the continuity of the conditions of life within history." Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that wonderfully thorough and rigorous lecture and view of the historiography that we've started out very well this evening. We have 15 minutes for questions or any discussion or any points people want to make. There are two people, I think, with roving mics. Yes, okay. Yes, here we go. We have two people with roving mics. So we have a few minutes if the audience wants to come in for any questions or issues. There's one here.
Is it working?
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. That was an absolutely marvellous tour de force. A couple of things, perhaps you just fill out a little bit more. I'm sorry. Yes. You can hear better if you can see better, can't you? Yeah. A couple of things you just touched on, which perhaps you could just elaborate a little bit more. First of all, was the role of the German church in the, I'm thinking particularly of people like Kittel and Bundmann and people of that sort. And also the mentality of the Irvings of this world, the Holocaust deniers, and how that sort of argument could possibly have been sustainable or thought to be sustainable.
The second question I did.
The second is the Holocaust deniers and to what extent that kind of argument can be sustainable.
Yes. Well, the role of the German church, you mean the churches, that is the Catholic and the Protestant, I guess. As you know, the evangelical church, that is the Protestant, was divided in Deutsche Christen, the German Christians, which were Nazis, often card-carrying Nazis, and members of the church. They tried, as you know, to Arianize completely the Bible and everything. I mean, Jesus was an Arian for them. Yet then you had the confessing church, which rose as a counter effect to the German Christians. Let me say immediately, I am a great admirer of the confessing church and some of its main figures. But it, when confronted by the authorities, it ultimately submitted to their dictates every time. And in the middle between the two, you had a nondescript, the mass actually of German Protestants, who followed the guidelines of the higher authority of the evangelical churches in Germany. And I will give you one example of their position in very early, in December 41, but it's important because it's at the time when Hitler took the decision, most probably, to exterminate all the Jews. As you know, well, in September of that year, the Yellow Star had been introduced in Germany. Every Jew had to carry this yellow tag. And in December, as there were now questions about converted Jews going to church, to temple, with that yellow star. There was a directive from the highest authority of the Evangelical Church that the Evangelical Church doesn't take any responsibility for the converted Jews, not for the Jews, for the converted Jews, and they should take care of their own religious needs. That is, they are not anymore accepted within the community of Christians, of which they are part, it seems. So that's why the Evangelical Church immediately in 45 came out with this declaration of guilt. But as I said, it was very much opposed within the church itself in 45, this declaration, the Stuttgart Declaration. Now, the Catholic Church, in both churches, you had a few heroic figures. I mean, no doubt. The Catholic Church was more anti-Nazi at the very beginning, until 33, of course. Then it adapted, but always it was also considered a political church by the Nazis themselves, because, of course, the center was in Rome. And therefore, the importance of Pius XII's personality in this matter. The Catholic Church had more, not vocal, because all was done not publicly, I would say more opponents. But ultimately, and that is the great question, I am grateful for your question. Ultimately, when they were told, Bishop Preising of Berlin and the evangelical Bishop Wurm in Württemberg, I think, when they were told by Hitler's head of office, don't send any more questions about the Jewish issue, because they asked, they didn't say anything, but they asked what is happening and so on in order to create. When they were told stop it, they stopped. That is nobody except Provost Lichtenberg in St. Hedwig in Cathedral in Berlin, to whom I will come in a second, nobody of the higher ranks dared to choose martyrdom or to say, well, here I stand. That is, when they were told shut up, they shut up. Lichtenberg was a unique case, and it has to be remembered. He was, in a way, lowly. He was a deacon in St. Hedwig. And he already, during the Kristallnacht in 1938, protested against what was happening, the burning of synagogues and so on. When the Jews, the deportation started in October of 1941, he publicly said, let's pray for our brethren, the Jews, was denounced immediately by women in the church, was taken by the Gestapo and died on his way to Dachau, I think. So he died, but he spoke. And he's, to my knowledge, the voice which publicly spoke. The astonishing question is that, if you think of it, nobody of higher rank, bishop, and took a similar stand in evangelical circles or in Catholic circles throughout Germany, throughout the war. The second question was the negationists, Irving and so on. How does it, how are they answerable, their questions? Of course they are. I mean, I don't think that a tribunal should be the place to decide those things, but there were excellent people at the court case in London. Of course, the questions they ask, if you know the material well, you immediately see that something is wrong in the question. But not many people, if I may say, know the material well. For example, I happened to have been involved, but that's 20 years ago or so, in a debate with a French negationist, it was not Faurisson, but somebody like him, saying, well, the Gerstein report, that is the report written immediately at the end of the war by a German Protestant, and given to the Americans and then to the French. And this Gerstein was the man who supplied the Cyclone B gas to the camps. So he was, on the one hand, a criminal. On the other hand, he was a hero in a way, but not heard, nobody listened to him. And so this report was quoted in Nuremberg at the trial. So this negationist, again, not Faurisson, but like him, said, look, Gerstein has invented all this story of the, he was a witness to the gassings. And many people thought, well, yes, maybe Gerstein invented the whole thing. Well, the guy who said that forgot that there was another person with Gerstein who wrote a totally independent report, and then a professor of medicine, Pfannenstiel from Tübingen, was there and looked also through the little window into the gas chamber and said, oh, they are shouting because the diesel engine did not start. And that was one of the earliest gas chambers. Oh, they are shouting like in a synagogue. And that was reported then, and he himself then admitted having said that, so that Gerstein actually was, and Gerstein says, I was there with Pfannenstiel. But the negationist, let's say, said, well, Gerstein invented the whole thing, forgetting that some people knew there was another person.
There are two questions in the back there. We can just, I tell you, if we can have both of the questioners asking their question, and then we'll have a response.
You will be my memory.
I will be your memory, yes.
I'm interested in your opinion on Jonathan Littell's book, his novel. Do you think that Les Bienveillantes, do you think that this book has anything to contribute to the treatment of...
Which book? We didn't get it here.
Jonathan Littell, the novel, I think in English it's The Kindly Ones.
On The Kindly yeah. Ones. Well, my opinion is very negative.
Okay, well, I'd still like to hear it.
You want a long explanation? No. In short, it not only because of the, how can I say, about the crude kind of the pleasure he takes in fecal descriptions. How can I? This simply is his way. But that wouldn't have bothered me. But what bothered me is that he gave a kind of mythical subtext, if you notice that. It's built on actually Aeschylus' tragedy. That is, he creates first this kind of person like the SS hero of the story never existed and could not exist, somebody going from place to place. Therefore, it is a kind already in itself a totally constructed idea of somebody seeing everything. But then the whole, you know, you remember he kills his parents and so on, or his supposed parents when he goes back to France for a while. That is, it is all a Greek tragedy, actually, which is a mythification, and on top of it, or below it, the kind of gross descriptions leave you a feeling of, to me at least, it was not, I mean, there are some historical novels, and this is just a historical novel, which make some sense. I mean, I could give you a few names, but this had great success in France, as you know, had two major prizes, not in the States, by the way, which means nothing. But I don't know how it did here, but it's in my opinion, it's a book which I would keep away from, but it's gone, you see. It's
a
gone.
Very clear answer. There's somebody next to you with a question, too.
Yes.
Sorry, I've got a more like history-related question. I suppose the Holocaust, one of the major things that have come out of studying the Holocaust is the psychoanalysis and interview techniques of Holocaust victims, as well as trying to figure out what actually happened in these scenes of atrocity. I'm not quite sure whether you dealt on it in detail, and I was wondering what your opinion on where the future is going from here, because I think You began your lecture by saying that in 1989, on the 200th anniversary, it was announced that the French Revolution had passed into history. In that case, is the Holocaust not yet history, no, but just an emotional narrative?
It's a mix, of course, if that is the gist of the question. It is a mix. I mean, that was my point. As it has not passed into mere history from this intertwining of history and public memory. And I know I said it quickly, but that this memory is, there is still personal memory, but that will disappear within the next few years, right? Biological reasons. But the public memory is constructed by mass media and so, but it goes on. And that's the difficulty. You have to fight off constructions in a way which interfere with historiography, but then historiography is part of its surroundings, as we all know here. So I think that this will go on, for better or worse, for quite some time because the Holocaust, for some reason, has become the measuring rod of other genocides. Usually, there is a tendency to compare, to say, well, are the events in Darfur really something similar, and so on, or Bosnia, or, of course, Cambodia, Rwanda, and so on. And the comparison is absolutely, is very important to see the similarities and, of course, see also the difference. But it is a measuring rod. And it is used, actually, in the public discourse, maybe too much. But that is the situation which will probably go on for a while. How long I don't know. You will see it, probably.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid, I hate to say we're out of time because we have to take our distinguished speaker to Trinity. But I'm sure that you would join me in saying thank you again for a marvelous lecture and wonderful questions and answers as well. Thank you very much.